Throughout the early childhood years, there are opportunities for every child's potential to blossom and for a lifelong love of learning to begin. Welcome to Lilio. Our solutions for center management, family engagement, teaching and learning, and professional development have impacted countless educators, children, and families. We stand as a symbol of quality and commitment to early childhood education, with the belief that early educators have the power to change children's lives and ultimately the world. Lilio, the building blocks for high-quality childcare. Learn more at www.lilio.com.
Hey everyone, it's David Duchovny. Do you ever feel like a failure? Trust me, I get it. Hell, I've spent my whole life almost feeling like a failure. It's appropriate, though, because on Fail Better, my new podcast with Lemonada Media, exploring the world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives, is the whole point. Each week, I'll chat with artists, athletes, actors, and experts about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, I hope we can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out on May 7th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada. Hello, kids. We are back for another episode of Raised by Ricky. I, of course, am Ricky Lake.
And it's your boy, Kaylin Allen. Mm. I don't know why I said it like that.
And Kaylin, you crack me up. You are one of the funniest people I know. Do you consider yourself a comedian?
No. It is so funny you say that because people ask me this all the time. And I consider myself to be a comedic entertainer. I know how to perform comedy. Now, in a world, do I believe that I could practice and figure out how to do stand-up? Yes. But if I did stand-up, all my funniest, like, stand-up style jokes are always inappropriate.
Really?
Like, there are a lot of times that I come up with jokes and I'd be like, damn, I'm never seeing heaven.
I know. I have conversations with my husband that actually just stay in
exactly,
this house,
you know? Right?
Like, yeah. Are you good at improv?
Yes. Very much so.
I'm terrible at improv.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not good if I have to be funny. Mm-hmm. You know, I can tell stories and I can be funny, but that is a different kind of skill set. I guess on my show, I used to be like, it was all quick on my feet, but it wasn't to be funny. It was to tell a story. It was to bring on drama. It was, you know, it was different than improv. I used to be like in the late 80s, when I moved to California for the first time, I became a groundling groupie. Do you know the groundlings?
Mm-mm.
It's an improv group. They have a theater on Melrose. And I mean, Kristen Wiig, Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry, Paul Rubens, you name it. Like all the best of the best. Are you Googling them right now? But yeah, are you impressed with that list of people
I
that
am.
Came out of there? Who impresses you?
I mean, Kristen Wiig, come on.
Oh, yeah. Melissa McCarthy.
Yeah, like, icon.
Rachel Harris, Cheryl Hines. I mean, there's the list of women, Lisa Kudrow. Mm. And I used to sit in the theater and just, like, be a wannabe.
That makes me think of Second Stage, too.
It's a similar thing. There's also UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade, which, you know, Rachel Bloom, who, I don't know, do you know Rachel Bloom?
Yes.
I'm obsessed with her.
Really?
I'm obsessed. I think she is so, that show specifically, that Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is my favorite television show of all time.
Have you ever met her?
I did an episode of it. I sang with Amber Riley.
Oh, I know Amber.
We played Dream Ghosts, like kind of like Dream Girls. You're going to find it. It was magic. I loved every minute of it. And that show is really brilliant.
I think when it comes to comedy, I think for me personally, the people that I regard or like, the physical comedic actors, like the Eddie Murphys. I talk about this all the time. Jim Carrey should have won an Oscar for The Grinch. That is one of the most...
And for Mask and for
like,
everything
I'm like,
he's done.
Yeah. These are spectacular performances that I feel like...
I love them too.
Jim Carrey, I think Raven Simone deserves so much more credit for her her comedic chops.
Okay, what work are you talking about?
Like That's So Raven, Disney Channel.
I was a little too old for that, so I never got into that. But I'll take your word for it.
Oh, I mean, that's some incredible work.
Yeah, there's certain people that are so good with timing. Mm-hmm.
like can just deliver and deliver.
Well, and that's why I always say comedic entertainer, because that's what I get. I know timing, because comedy is all about rhythm. If you don't have rhythm, it doesn't work. Syntax and diction also matter when it comes to a joke or being able to land a punchline. A lot of people don't understand that.
Now, you and I may not be stand-up comedians per se, but today we're talking with basically a legend, one of my favorites from stage and screen, Margaret Cho. I've known her kind of like, not well, but I feel like we're friends, you know, I've known her for a little while, but I'm so excited to talk to her.
I am. You know, I actually worked with Margaret once on a panel at Netflix when I lived in Los Angeles.
Well, we're going to talk with her. We have questions about her time as a sex worker, and we want to talk to her about some of the sexier Ricky Lake shows. Does that sound good?
Big power. Sound good to me.
All right. I hear, Caitlin, do you hear that?
I do hear something.
Who's with you?
This is Lucia.
Oh, hello, Lucia.
Lucia Caterina.
Oh, my goodness. Lucia. Thank you both for joining us today.
So cute.
Very happy to have you.
Thank you.
Margaret Cho, I've loved you. I've known you for a long, long, long time.
Yes.
Like both personally a little and professionally. We've worked together indirectly, like Masked Singer and crazy stuff. But you, I also want to take this opportunity to make a public apology to you.
Why?
Because you were on my last, not the original talk show. I don't think you were ever on the OG Ricky Lake show, but you were on my last talk show that only ran for 1 year. Do you recall?
Oh, yeah.
So, okay, do you have any recollection of me and maybe my hosting skills or that lack thereof on that day?
No, you're amazing. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, you're an icon and I have loved you for so long, so I don't know exactly what you're getting at.
I'm not even fishing for compliments, but thank you. But, so let me explain. Let me paint the picture. So I went back to do a second talk show because, you know, I felt like I'd evolved and they came to me with, you know, wanting me to go back on the air. And I made this decision with this specific company to do more of like a Phil Donahue type of show. That I wanted my provocative, elevated content for people. You know, I just, after making my documentaries, I wanted to focus more on like real, like impactful, hopefully, and not like meaningless hour. Anyway, cut to, I get in bed with this company that assures me that's what they want to do too. We were not a good fit. I was miserable. And I started medicating on that job at the very end of the season when I knew the show was being canceled. I started using cannabis, which is not something other than, I guess I use it in this podcast and this job, but I was not prone to using cannabis during the work hours. Mm-hmm. And it just got harder and harder at the end of this thing. And maybe I'm telling too long-winded of a story of this, but I just remember having you on the show, someone I really admire and look up to. And I wasn't even present. Like, I couldn't even, I feel like I was like, blah, 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 blah,
oh,
on the couch
no.
with you. It was so awful. And I just felt like you must have thought to yourself, what a fucking quack. And anyway, so I apologize for being unprofessional in that moment.
You know what? I've done so many drugs. I don't even have that memory in my hard drive.
Good.
Like that was deleted so long. I have no idea. I mean, I really have brain damage from drug use, not just cannabis. All sorts.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. My brain is damaged from the use of Ambien over the years. I don't know what.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I ate a whole banana cream pie on Ambien. I've like really eaten a lot of Marie Callender's inventory.
Yeah.
Both hot and cold pies. Ambien and Marie Callender should do a collab.
I mean, I actually once, I, on that drug with a little alcohol, I signed up to eHarmony while I had a boyfriend and didn't even know what I was doing. I mean, it was one of those things, you know, first of all, I'm Jewish. So the eHarmony, you know, that is not the right outlet for me to look for love, particularly while I'm in a relationship. And I filled out that extensive, it's like an hour long profile. And I didn't remember it. The next day I had no idea. And the boyfriend at the time found it on my computer, like in a shortcut, the eHarmony. Like I kept getting matches. I thought it was spam. No, I'd signed up to this thing. I went back and looked at my profile. I had filled out, yes, my favorite book is The Kite Runner. You know, like I just did the whole thing.
Girl, and I tried to adopt a child.
Adopt a child?
Girl, I was I signed up to like some Christian adoption aid. Like, I was like,
you win.
Who did this?
You win. You win.
Who did this? It's so strange, that drug. I can't use any kind of sleep, anything, because I love any kind of sleep drug. So that's actually one of my basically bottom lines, is I cannot do any kind of sleep drug.
I'm a gummy girl. I'm a Ooh, cannabis yeah. gummy every night, all night.
It's yeah, good.
I love it every day.
Cannabis is good.
Every day. I also grow weed too. I become yeah. a cannabis like
connoisseur.
I don't know if I'm a connoisseur, but I'm definitely like a daily user. I'm an advocate. Mm-hmm. I made a documentary about it. But like back when I did my show, back in, when I was, you know, your age, Kaylin. Kaylin is 26, by the way, mm-hmm. Margaret.
Child.
He didn't grow up with the Ricky Lake show, but he's definitely like taking the Cliff Note version on this job.
Oh, I love it.
But yeah, I was the Nancy Reagan, like, disciple. Just say no to drugs. Like, I was fear-filled. Mm-hmm. I was very judgmental. It freaked me out. And then, I've evolved, and you know, cannabis. I just love that medicine, and it's helped me with my sleep yeah. and my time with my husband. It's amazing. Anyway, let's talk about sex workers.
Yes,
let's talk about, because on my old show, and you talked about me in some of your routines with my show. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you are a fan of the Ricky Lake show. You watched it.
I loved it. I love Ricky, just because I think that we were really outspoken in the 90s. We were the few women out there who had body, oddy, 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 oddy. We had curves, we had opinions. Mm-hmm. And I really always felt very connected with you. And of course, there's also the Chicago connection with all the funny people, like from the Real Brady Bunch and the Annoyance Theater.
Yep.
So we had a connection there. But also, I mean, I've just been a fan for so long. So, yes, I watched the show and everything.
Do you remember how we used to portray, you know, sex workers, prostitution? We did a number of those shows back then.
Well, it was more like, I think sex work has always been portrayed as something that people would participate in, not necessarily by choice. That mm-hmm. most of the focus was on survival sex work, or sex work that you would do because there were no other options. Whereas my experience with sex work, I did phone sex when I was a teenager, which was really hard. It's hard to keep somebody on the phone until they nut. Mm. And you got to keep talking.
How long would it take? I mean, what on average?
Well, I was never good at it. So they moved me to recorded phone sex so that I would be recording these like scripts.
Mm. Right.
And where were you living at this time?
San Francisco.
Okay, so you're living in San Francisco. And what was your initial reaction to the job?
I really enjoyed it because it was, it really taught me how to do ADR. Mm. It taught me how to work in a recording studio. It was my first experience in a recording studio. So from then, I've gotten a lot of voiceover jobs. I mean, to this day, I am still doing a lot of jobs in animation. And because of my experience doing that, like, I learned how to sync sound, to modulate my voice, to podcast even. So you learn how to speak. So I don't have a negative thought about it, but it was definitely sex work.
Did you feel empowered in any way, or did you feel objectified?
No, because it was not really about anything except talking. Mm-hmm. You know, I just felt like a channel for this kind of energy. Because I would walk past all the girls talking on the phone, because there was a huge office and they would all have these cubicles and they'd be talking to guys, trying to get them to stay on the phone as long as possible. Every cubicle, there was something different going on. There was one girl like slapping her hand in one cubicle, and there was another one screaming, and like, everybody had a different like sort of brand.
What was your specialty?
Yeah, what was it?
Mine was English as a second language, as sex talk. So I would use very simple structures of sentences, like noun, verb.
Oh my gosh.
Sentences that were really just like for people learning English, just getting started in this language.
Wow.
That is so interesting to me.
Yes.
I would think the office was pretty chaotic.
Yes.
To be able to be on the phone. And then you got all these different noises and sounds happening.
Yes. So very chaotic. But then at the end of the hall, they had the recording studio. So that's where I would sit and I would just do these things about, my name is Mandy. I have blonde hair. My eyes are blue. My breasts are 36 double D.
So you had to play like a white woman.
I was always white.
Wow.
Always white. Because if you're learning English, I guess the emissary should be sort of blonde hair, blue-eyed white woman. Mm. Yes.
You weren't in high school. You'd already finished high school at this point.
I had dropped out. So I dropped out about 16. So I was probably like 16, 17. I was definitely not old enough to be there. But since it was not actually talking to anybody, and it was sort of all under the table, I don't know exactly if it was illegal or not. I'm not sure. Because at that time, we didn't have those sorts of thoughts about, oh, is this illegal? Because it wasn't actual contact with anybody.
Margaret, this is a movie, and I want
it. I know it really
right.
is.
Did your mom know?
My mom did not know. And when I told her about it later, she didn't really understand. So, oh, so then you English teacher. Yeah. Yes, English teacher. Okay.
Wow.
With some specialties.
Yes, some specialties.
Oh, my gosh, that's crazy. All right, let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Throughout the early childhood years, there are opportunities for every child's potential to blossom, for curiosity to spark, and for a lifelong love of learning to begin. Welcome to Lilio. We develop innovative tools that revolutionize the connection between daycare centers and families and help empower educators, enabling them to nurture young minds and build strong bonds. Through our solutions for center management, family engagement, and teaching and learning, plus professional development through Lilio Academy, where educators can earn continuing education credits at their own pace, we've impacted countless educators, children, and families. We stand as a symbol of quality and commitment to early childhood education. With the belief that early childhood educators have the power to change children's lives and ultimately the world. Join us in nurturing the future. Welcome to Lilio, the building blocks for high quality childcare. Learn more at www.lilio.com.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, let's talk about your advocacy work, because you have been an advocate forever of sex positivity and the LGBTQIA+ and their rights. Mm-hmm. How did you first get into it?
When I was also working at that job, the other job that I got after that was making leather dildos at a store called Stormy Leather, which was a BDSM collective. It was a business that was catering to leather women in San Francisco, because we had a very long established leather man businesses. They didn't have one for women. Leather society has always been a big part of dyke culture. Yes. In San Francisco and all over the world. Their retail store opened, so I helped them out.
Wow. So that was your start. And so when you started to have, you know, fame and get a name for yourself and you were out there, this was the obvious issue you wanted to talk about.
Yes, because sex positivity was always something that was really important to me. I think because also my parents had a gay bookstore in San Francisco in the 70s. So, you know, we lived through the first pandemic, which for us was AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So when the queer community were still looking to feel bold sexually, and we didn't really know how to do that. You know, you want sex to still feel like exciting and fun. And, you know, at that time, this idea of safe sex was so pervasive. And there was so much fear around that how do we keep sex intense and alive for us? So the BDSM community really flourished because it was a way to keep sex in a kind of exciting space without necessarily fluid bonding, without necessarily sort of endangering yourself to HIV or AIDS. It was really about finding a way to engage that was all about the mental sort of like stimulation of it and creating a lifestyle around sex that was safe, but also emotionally and physically exciting.
Mm, wow. I've never heard that perspective.
Yeah. Sex can be very exciting, but when you're dealing with something that's a deadly disease, how do you get that escape that sex should give us when it's really alive and thrilling? Sex should feel, I don't know, like a dangerous thing, but not actually be dangerous.
Right.
And so BDSM was the perfect avenue for that.
Wow. I mean, do you think like with the pandemic of late, you know, I mean, we all had to sort of shut down and change the way we got close to people, right? Do you think it was similarities?
Yes, for sure. I mean, AIDS had a long sort of a gestation period and like we really couldn't figure out what was going on. We had so much misinformation, you know, and so much denial of its even existence. So there was more of a long-term effect of that. But I think with COVID-19, there's a sense of like, how do we connect without endangering ourselves? So people hot FaceTimes, hot Zooms, you know, you had this sort of sense of connecting through thoughts, through technology that I think was really meaningful. So there was some similarity, but gay people do it better, always. Gay people always do everything better. We're just better.
Exactly. Well, I also think the difference from the two is that when the AIDS and HIV epidemic happened, that was specifically targeting a part of the world that people wanted out of here anyway, you know, that and which is right. what led right. to a lot of the denial and not accepting it because they were like, this is from God. He's getting rid of all these people, right. blah, 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 blah. While COVID is something that affected everybody, you know, and anybody can, and mm-hmm. we knew that even though HIV is something that anybody can get, it does primarily affect, you know, the queer community the most. But I do think that we were mm-hmm. teetering on the line of almost experiencing it again when monkeypox,
I was
introduced right. because when monkeypox became first a thing, especially here in New York, it was only surrounded by gay men. Right. It was like, this is a gay disease. And we saw ourselves about to really get into a very dangerous territory of reliving what that was like.
Exactly. It's just people just want to hate gay people. They just want to find excuses. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, something that we've had to fight for so long. It's so frustrating.
It is. I mean, that's one of the things looking back on the old show. It's like we really did show gay people and gay relationships like any other, you know, and mm-hmm. I think that was helpful mm-hmm. at the time. You know, we're in doing this show, we're connecting with people that were personally impacted by, you know, growing up in the middle of nowhere, not seeing anyone in their towns that look like them, that talk like them, and yet they can turn on the show after school every day and see someone
yeah.
that definitely looks familiar, you know?
Yeah, which is such a great thing about the show is that, you know, people were like able to feel like they existed by seeing examples of themselves, which is really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Would you say you could say that for yourself? Do you think you watched the show and saw people that reminded you of you?
Absolutely. Because you brought in the hag. You were like bringing hags into like, you know, the girls that hang out with gay men.
Okay,
the hag
yeah.
experience, like for me, hag is sort of a negative word to, but I love that because I refer to
yes,
myself as a
yes,
hag.
I'm a hag.
I was born a hag.
At 18, I became an honorary hag in Hairspray with that crew.
Right. You were actually like knighted by the hag meister, John Waters. Like that was like the ultimate honors to be given that title by Waters. You know, that's incredible. It's where hags really shined was in your show.
Okay, so you've surrounded yourself all your life with gay men.
I started being involved with gay men when I was 14, but I stopped trying to have sex with them by the time I was 18. I caught on. My advice for every other hag up there is you need...
Again with the words!
But it's a descriptive.
Okay.
It's the only word we have.
No, that's fruit fly.
Fruit fly.
Do you find that offensive? Fruit fly. Or I like yeah. Queen of the Queens. Yeah, I kind of like that one.
You had experience and, you know, seeing us, and so you were bringing them on to the show. It's just like, we're here. It's so exciting.
when it comes to your background and these different careers that you have experienced, how has it influenced your comedy? How did you find the connection from the life that you were living and finding a way to break into the industry?
Well, as like a comedian, I started in AIDS fundraising in the late 80s, early 90s. I remember Ian McKellen had just come out. And so we were doing big benefits for him, and he was coming out and raising money for AIDS. And so I would be there and he would be there. And like, we would just be doing these like little drag shows also. So I got my start really within the gay community, doing shows for ourselves in order to kind of combat the ignorance, the invisibility of HIV and AIDS. So it just seemed like a natural fit to continue on in that. Plus, I was also so different from any other comedian then. You know, everybody was white, straight, male. So there was something about needing to talk about my identity, too, within my comedy, which makes you stand out. So if you're a comedian, I think oftentimes your identity is currency. So it made me very wealthy in that because I had a lot to share.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that. And how do you think in today's day and age, how do you think sex work has changed? Because I know now in today's day and age, we have things such as like OnlyFans, and we have all these different resources that have almost to an extent, especially within the gay male arena, has normalized, you know, sex work. So how do you think it has changed? Because I know you talked about sex work being more of a survival thing back in the day. So how do you see the scope of sex work in today's day and age?
I think it's wonderful. I think it gives people a lot of freedom to express themselves and to feel joy doing it and make some money, which is really awesome. I really admire the way that people have taken charge and you know, making such great careers for themselves in this industry, which I think is really cool. I think it's something that has lost its stigma, although there's still some stigma there. It's really like we're able to rise above it, which I think is amazing.
Well, a conversation that I know that we often have within the community is the fact that now sex workers, especially those that are considered more on the porn star side of things, have become more with some type of celebrity status, specifically within the community. And I know an argument that has been talked about lately is that with sex work becoming so normalized, that it is becoming oversaturated, you know, and to the point to where they feel like there's too many people that exist in the space. And then that's what makes it actually harder for people to be successful in the field. Do you have any thoughts on that? Or do you see it as just like the more the merrier?
I think it's a marketplace like anything else. So, you know, you have to bring something new and thrilling to market. I think that it's still a product that you've got to sell. And so that's sort of like, what are you offering and how is it different from what everybody else is offering? Is the price competitive? Can you make it feel different? It's all like, I think it's up to the consumer ultimately, but you know, it's also, these people are artists.
Right.
So now it's kind of up to us to create something different and new and exciting. And what can we do to make it work for us?
I love that. I love that. And if you could plan an episode of like the Ricky Lake Show or even any talk show or any way that we talk about sex work in, mainstream media today, what are adjustments that you would want people to use in the way that they talk about sex work that wasn't being done in the 90s when the Ricky Lake Show and other shows were talking about sex work?
I think it's really like, how can we make positive changes and create some more advocacy around sex work and to really look at it beyond the lens of shame and look at it as a practical way for people to make a living. And then also to make sure that they are protected by law, you know, and having rights
insurance,
and having
health insurance,
safety, which I think is really, really important. Mm-hmm. It's still illegal. To decriminalize sex work is important. I think a lot of people have opinions about legalizing it fully because of their own approach to the work, but I think it should definitely be decriminalized and certainly I want to make a safer environment for people who are experiencing homelessness, who are in a place where they're using sex work as a means to survival. You know, how do we make the world safer for them? There's a lot of issues that I think can be addressed when we remove the shame and stigma from the work itself.
Well said. Okay, folks, got to take a quick break, but we're going to be right back in a jiffy.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And each week we are sitting down to talk all about life's twists, turns, and absurdities on The Deep Dive.
From exploring the depths of TikTok, which is our only news source, to navigating the complexities of grief and loss, we are just two best friends behind a mic processing life together.
This podcast is all about finding the silver linings in the madness. So get ready for unfiltered conversations about motherhood, careers, pop culture, and everything in between.
Here at The Deep Dive, we're all about community. We believe in the power of sharing experiences and the strength that comes from supporting one another. And we would love to have you with us.
So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Yes, you know, I make documentaries and, you know, I'm pretty open about everything in my life. And you are too. You know, you are no stranger to sharing details about your sex life and your comedy. What drives you to be so open?
I think it's the constant evolution of my own sexuality and the way that I feel about towards these subjects. But like I have identified in different ways. Right now, I'm definitely queer, but also I think I'm asexual. Like I think I've actually gotten to the other side of sex. You mean
like post-menopause?
Post-menopause, post-romantic feelings, post-love. In that romantic love aspect.
So wait, explain that. What do you think that is? You think like it's a chemical thing that or a hormonal thing that you just are shut down in that way?
I think so, but it's not exactly shut down. It's more open. It's actually like now I'm definitely like much more intimate in my relationships, but not necessarily intimate physically.
Wow, interesting.
So the intimacy, it really is about the heart and coming together in a soul way, but not in a physical way. So it's a really interesting place to be in because, you know, my mother had a hysterectomy. All of her sisters had hysterectomies like in the 70s. So nobody was immediately there to kind of inform me how my body would change through menopause because they all had this artificial menopause like in their 30s.
You know, this is my latest movie. This is my latest documentary. It's The Business of Birth Control. So it's all about the hormones. And, you know, we would love to do a follow-up about menopause. Now, I know, Caitlin, this is so not in your freaking lexicon, wheelhouse, whatever, but I'm just going to say it is such an interesting thing. And there's something to be said for a woman that go, and I'm still, I still get my period. I still get a cycle, even though I'm 54. But menopause is really, if you switch the script on it, it's an amazing time for a woman.
The best. For,
you know, the best. That's what I mean. And that's, I want to, as I go through it and have ultimately a great experience past crossing over to menopause. Yeah, there's something we need to celebrate that our body is not having to take that energy of producing that egg every month. You know, it can really be honed into us other things.
Oh, it's the best thing. It's menopause is the greatest kept secret of life for me. Like I realize like my brain is opening up and it's basically puberty again.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then you age into who you actually are supposed to be. When you're no longer regulated by hormonal thoughts or hormonal like actions or any kind of chemical. Like, you are just yourself.
Liberating.
It's so liberating, but it's also something that society wants to deny because society hates that women can be more powerful.
Exactly.
They don't want us to be so powerful. And menopause is real power. The age of the crone is the real, you know, she's the real MVP. And it's really important to embrace that. But society wants us to feel like spinsters or dried up or over. But it's actually, no, life just starts at this. So it's powerful.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I'm super, I'm ready. You know, I'm ready. Okay, so Margaret, I know in your comedy album, Drunk with Power, you talk about me and my old show. And I don't know if you remember, but it was like you had lost weight, I guess. What was your journey like going through, you know, that period of being just scrutinized for your body? I remember on that sitcom you were on, you were pressured, correct?
It was so hard because, you know, we had an era of feminism. Like, there was a Riot Girl movement and there was like all these like bands with great female vocalists coming out, but we still had this idea of like, you've got to look like Kate Moss. It's like really
what
hard.
Year was this, would you say?
This is like 94.
Okay, so the second year of my show.
Yeah, 94. Very challenging to be on television as a woman and to not feel like you could own the space. You had to be smaller. And so it was very physically, like my body doesn't go that small.
So what did you do to fit that mold?
Oh, I took a lot of Fen-Phen.
I did too. Yep, I'm familiar with Fen-Phen.
That drug, which is so bad.
Do you know about that, Kaylin? You're nodding your head. You've heard of that drug?
Oh, you told us.
It was two drugs. Oh, I did two drugs that you took, and it was basically speed, and it really fucked up a lot of people's hearts, right? There were a lot of complications.
Yeah, so bad. But and they gave it to me, and they're like, okay, don't drink when you take this. And when somebody says, don't drink when you take this, I hear, drink when you take this. So I was like so wasted. And it really pushed me into a place that was really bad. But I did lose a lot of weight from that. But it wasn't worth it.
I mean, where are you now with you? I mean, you look amazing. I've actually seen like you. Do you? Is it hard for you to maintain where you are now?
No, because I don't do anything. I mean, I have a lot of cats. I run after them. I'm cleaning up. I have my dog. We walk every day. It's not like a journey that is something that I think about very much. But because of that, maybe because my shift in focus on my spiritual life and, you know, it's so like there that I don't really think about that. But I don't know. Like it's just the shift in hormones and shift in focus has really made that a lot easier. Also, society has changed. You know, society's approach to the body and especially women's bodies has really shifted because it was so like normalized to fat shame everybody and anybody who, especially if it was women who were outspoken. You know, that was so normalized. And so now we have an attitude shift in society, which I think is really valuable.
All right. One more question. We spend a lot of time looking back on my show from the 90s. How do you look back at comedy from the 90s?
I think I look back at it in a way that's very bittersweet because there was a lot of misogyny. There was a lot of homophobia and racism that was totally
acceptable, right? It was just accepted.
Acceptable. Yeah. I think that people mourn that, you know, like, oh, you can't make a joke about anything nowadays. Yeah, you shouldn't sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I think comedy is in a much better place now. I think it's really about skill and finesse and your ability to create like these entire castles with your imagination, but doesn't have to put anybody down, which I think is really awesome. So I think it's a lot better.
All right. Thank you so much, Margaret. Thank you. Thank
you.
Yes,
thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun talking to Margaret. I had so much fun. It was so cool because I've known her for so long and it just is nice to reconnect in this way and really talk about the old show in the 90s and Margaret's awesome.
So, Ricky, so, like, we've talked to a lot of people, right? And a lot of people that you've either had a personal relationship with or you've been a fan of or been able to get into contact with. So my question is, now that you look back of all these people that we've reconnected with, is there anything that you, like, has new stuff started to resurface within you of this past life? Because, and the reason why I ask you this is because I know the other day we were taping and you were like, I'm starting to realize that maybe I took it for granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there is some truth to that. You know, I think when I was just, every job was just like the next thing that came along and I just jump in and I mm-hmm. give my all. And if it's a hit, it's a hit. If it flops, it flops. Like, I move on to the next thing. And the show, you know, I plopped into the show and it just was truly a phenomenon. And I'm in this role as really a very young person who has not had a lot of life experience. And I'm suddenly moderator and host and, you know, therapist and, you know, comedian and like all these skills that I didn't think I had, you know, and certainly didn't train to do. But now, you know, 30 years later, 25 years later, looking back on these episodes and these experiences and these topics we covered, I mean, I'm seeing now that people were really deeply, deeply connected and moved and inspired and learned things. And it's way more positive like than I think when I was in it and we were taking heat for being like trash TV and there was a lot of like pushback and, you know, we were the darling when we first launched and then we were never nominated for an Emmy again. You know, it was kind of like this like stain on the genre itself and the way we produce the show. But yeah, I mean, I do think we did a lot of really powerful work culturally, you know, for young people to have a voice and to be seen and heard and represented. Yeah, I definitely have more reverence for that experience and the opportunity. I certainly appreciated the job and the money that came along with it. But I'm just also like, personally, I think I evolved in a way that I would never have without being in that role. You know, I learned so much about relationships and people and human nature. And yeah, this journey has been super, super fun for me. Yeah, I'm learning a lot about myself too, you know, and I definitely don't want to go back and do that show again in the same way. But if I did do something, you know, I'm much more of like a full, well-rounded, evolved human than I was back then, you know?
I love that.
So I hope you enjoyed it too. Did you have fun, Kaylin?
I did. I had the most. Every day with Ricky Lake is just pure laughter and joy. You are like Christmas every day.
Oh, man. Are you going to be bringing gingerbread when you come to see me? I keep bringing that up. When you say Christmas, somewhere. I think of gingerbread.
I know.
I'm just kidding. You don't need to bring me anything, just yourself. All right, kids, thank you so much for listening. Please, if you like what you're hearing, what do they need to do, Kaylin?
Rate, review, and subscribe. Look, I remember.
Yes, subscribe, and then you'll get the next episode automatically and be a part of our community. Hope you listen next time.
Toodaloo.
Bye. Before we go, there's more Raised by Ricky with Lemonada Premium. I love these premium episodes because we do them AMA style, which I recently learned was Ask Me Anything. And coming up on Monday, you asked me what my most memorable fan encounter has been, and holy crap, you won't believe the answer. The only way to hear that is if you subscribe to Lemonada Premium now in Apple Podcasts. Raised by Ricky with Kaylin Allen is a Lemonada Media original. This show is produced by Chrissy Pease, Mariah Gossett, Nancy Rosenbaum, Claire Jones, and Tiffany Bowie.
Our Senior Director of New Content is Rachel Neal. VP of Weekly Production is Steve Nelson. Executive Producers are Stephanie Wittles-Wax, Jessica Cardova-Kramer, and DeRay McKesson.
The show is mixed by Kat Yore. Music is written and produced by Jellybean Benitez, Jason Peralta, and Jay Cutts for Jellybean Productions. Follow Raised by Ricky wherever you get your podcasts or listen ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership.
Feeling decision fatigue about what to make for dinner? We get it. I'm Jane Black.
And I'm Liz Dunn. We're veteran food journalists, and as parents ourselves, we know how hard it can be to feed your family.
That's why we created Pressure Cooker, a podcast that offers practical strategies for navigating the marketing madness and cultural expectations around mealtime.
Each week, we'll check in with the experts. From social media diet trends to baby-led weaning and AI meal planning, we have all your food-related questions covered.
Listen to Pressure Cooker wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Feminasty Erin Gibson.
And I'm homosensual Brian Safi.
And we're the co-hosts of the Attitudes Podcast,
where we talk about LGBT plus issues, gender issues, and pop culture.
Probably with much less respect than they deserve.
Look, it's a wild world, and we want to help you laugh at it. Plus, we discuss everything going on in our lives.
Like, what do you do when your husband accidentally starts a fire in a dumpster?
And the best armpit slapping techniques to get rid of the bags under your eyes. Thanks for the advice, Mom.
And of course, how to spin a wig around to achieve a brand new look.
Ah, stunning. So if you're a fan of high heel shoe chairs or have a crippling fear of hot air balloons, but also believe in social justice, then this show's for you.
Listen to Attitudes anywhere you get your podcasts.